Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Roger Silverstone. I'm the Director of Media at LSE, the LSE's program in Media and Communications. And I'd like to welcome you to this launch event, this launch lecture, of our new program, for our new program in Global Media and Communications. This is a two-year master's program that we have developed with colleagues from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, many of whom are here this evening, and I'd like to welcome them especially to the LSE this evening. This program is unique, we believe, in with the annals of, not the short annals, of media and communications teaching history. We think we've designed it to be a global program for global media in a global age, and we actually think it's going to be fantastically good. The students on the course will do a year here at the London School of Economics, and then lucky people will spend the next year in Los Angeles, two of the most significant media capitals in the world, learning from, I believe, two of the best faculty in their fields, and having a very good time,
sorry,
I suspect.
Train,
it's all right, Tony. I'm used to it. you may not have noticed that this evening's lecture and the reception to which you are all invited afterwards has been sponsored by Bloomberg. We are genuinely very grateful for their support and for their help in getting this event together, and I would like that, as it were, noted by everyone present. I'd also like to just indicate that Tony will be speaking for around 40 minutes, and there will be time for questions, and then, as I said, you're all invited afterwards to the reception upstairs. In this institution of all, it's very difficult to say anything particularly new about Tony Giddens. It's almost impossible to introduce him in a way that will make a difference, because he's so well known and so well respected in the institution. But so I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to say, however, is something that I feel that I would like to say and have not said publicly up to now, which is to really thank him for his enormous and significant support for the Media and Communications program here. I think he believes and believed that research and teaching in media and communications was crucial, is crucial, for the future of the social sciences. And it's also crucial as a component of LSE's current mission of engaging with the real world, in this case of media players and policy makers. And if he believes that, then I agree with him. We have gained hugely from his support, and I do actually think that the LSE is going through one of its great periods as an institution right now, and not a little, indeed a great deal, is due to his leadership of the institution. It is, for those of us who are here, an extraordinarily exciting place to be, and I hope that the Media and Communications program is in some small way at least contributing to that sense of excitement. So let me, without further ado, as they say, welcome Tony Giddens to give our inaugural lecture for the Media Communications Program, Living in a Global Age. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Well, it's news to me that I'm respected within the institution, but it's very nice to very nice to sort of think that it could be so. Can I say, just from the point of view of the LSE, how much we support this program, because it's a really big initiative for us. It's brought together two major schools. Working with USC so far has just been great. I'd like to welcome all the contingent from Annenberg School, most of whom sitting down the front row, therefore get crick necks at the end of this lecture. But I wish them a very happy stay in London. And as I understand it, you've already had a very fruitful beginning to the two-day conference this morning and this afternoon. So welcome everybody here, and I hope you have a really good stay in London and manage to wander around this interesting city. I think I need to thank Roger thanks Sonia and the others involved in the media program at the LSE. A lot of academics, as you know, are a bit sniffy about media and communications, but it shouldn't be, because I think you don't need tuppence of common sense to see that media and communications are transforming a good deal about our global society. And indeed, this is one of the themes of this lecture tonight. But I do think this program will be very successful. Students have a terrible hardship having to live 1 year in London and 1 year in Los Angeles, but we hope that somehow they'll cope. And I believe this program will expand to become one of the most influential, really, within the LSE. As Roger says, media communication has got a fairly short history, really. Well, no, I suppose it hasn't, because it goes back to Hilda Himmelbeit and so forth. But in terms of its expansion, that's relatively recent, and it's a very important thing for us, as he sits there all modestly on the stage. Anyway, thanks, Roger, for the introduction and for all the work he's done on this. What I'm going to talk about in this lecture is essentially what it means to be living in the first global age. I think that we are essentially the first citizens of something like a global cosmopolitan society, and we have to map out the contours of this emerging global order. I think when you discuss what it means to live in a global age, you have to start really with the extraordinary history of the notion of globalization and the incredible controversies that have arisen around it. I mean, in the LSE about 5 weeks ago, near the beginning of term, we advertised a panel discussion on globalization. I was on it, and three other leading academics from the LSE were on it, and 1,500 people watched this event. So there's extraordinary interest in the debate about globalization, and I would venture to say that debate is perhaps the most important debate going on, not just within the social sciences, but to some extent in the world at large, because it is a debate about what the 21st century will look like. It's a debate about what kind of institutional shape the new century will have. Now, the history of the notion of globalization is itself really interesting. Some of us as academics have been working on and using the notion of globalization for about 15 years or so. But I can assure you that at that time, 14, 15 years ago, it wasn't very widely used in the academic literature. It didn't feature certainly in the popular press. Certainly people didn't get agitated about the notion of globalization. So in a relatively short period, some 15 years, the concept of globalization has gone from more or less nowhere to become everywhere, because it's probably the most talked about social science notion that has penetrated popular consciousness, certainly for the past several decades. Now, when you get something happening like that, you know, a term suddenly becomes the center of attention, it's obvious that it will be followed by debate, and this has certainly happened. Very, very briefly, there are two phases in what David Held, professor of government here, calls the great globalization debate. The first phase began in something like the late 1980s, went through to 3 or 4 years ago. This was a debate about whether or not globalization is a reality at all. And there were many people who doubted it. They came to be called the globalization skeptics in the academic literature. They argue that, for example, if you look back 100 or so years ago, the end of the late 19th century, you already then had an open market economy which stretched across countries. You had a good deal of trade in currencies. You had a good deal of trade in commodities. People actually didn't need passports to travel between most countries at that time. You had the kind of mass migrations to the US and other parts of the world. So the skeptics said, well, what's new? Really, the current phase of globalization is at most a recapitulation of the past. But some people doubted that the phenomenon has any reality at all, and they would put globalization in quote marks to show that it was largely an empty notion. Well, this early debate, the first globalization debate, is now, at least in my view, over. We've had so much empirical work on what globalization means today that we can, I think, be quite assured that the current period of globalization, the current global age, is different from the late 19th century. It's much more intense than the late 19th century. Communications technologies play an important role in this. You've only got to look at the extraordinary advance of globalized, electronically carried financial markets to see that there is no real analog to that. Even a couple of decades ago, there was no real analog to that. David Held and his colleagues, in particular, have done a lot of research on these issues. They show, I think, quite definitively that globalization is different from the past. We're living through an intense period of global development that has parallels with the past. If you want, you could call the late 19th century the first global age, if you like, a global age that was aborted by two world wars, really. But this new global age is something different. It is not just a recapitulation of the past, whatever similarities it might share with it. In many respects, we're in new territory. As we enter the 21st century, we are in new territory in many areas of our lives. One of the main themes of what I want to say here tonight. That means that we can only, to some extent, lean on the past when we try to understand what this emerging global age is all about. The second globalization controversy, much more dramatic than the first, not just limited to the academic world. This is the globalization controversy which is still seething around us. This is the globalization controversy that brought people out in the streets in Seattle, in Washington, in London, in Buenos Aires, in Prague more recently. A whole variety of protestations, street protestations against the advance of globalization, pitting, as it were, the apparatchiks of the IMF and the WTO and the other global organizations against the protesters, the no logos, the people who see globalization as a destructive force which must be resisted and indeed turned back. The second globalization debate is much more interesting and informative and relevant to our lives than the first. Because, as I mentioned right at the beginning, this really is a debate about what kind of society is emerging before our eyes, and can we really manage the tremendous changes which are associated with the emergence of this global cosmopolitan order. One thing I must say, I think, however, about the second globalization debate, that it is not really, as its proponents suggest, a debate between those who are for globalization and those who are against it. You would imagine this is so because you have the people in the IMF and so forth who are promoting global markets, and outside you have the people protesting against them. But I think this is a false understanding. Much better to see it as a kind of collaboration and conflict between two sets of forces involved in globalization. Globalization from above, dominated by large agencies, including governments, versus globalization from below, which brings into play NGOs, agencies of numerous different kinds, themselves globalized, trying to produce a different kind of vision, as they would see it, of global social development from the first group. In his brief lecture, which he gave last year, Chris Patton quoted this very amusing and instructive illustration of this, which I also like to quote because it amused me too. He said he was looking at a TV image of the Seattle demonstrations, and someone was holding up a placard saying, "Join the worldwide movement against globalization." Well, what that shows is that the protesters are as much part of these processes as are the people they were protesting about, because, as we know, the internet, electronic communication, globalization of the groups involved, all these things were as much part and parcel of the critics and their mobilization as they are of the other group. So it is not possible simply to say, in my view anyway, one is either for or against globalization. The phenomenon is much too complicated and has too many diverse roots for that view to be cogent. Nor do I think either side,
the ones inside their conference rooms and the ones throwing stones through the windows have really understood or conceptualized globalization as it should be understood. I want to make a few comments on this before I come on, as it were, to the meat of the lecture. First, it's a great mistake, I think anyway, to conceptualize globalization as primarily economic, as simply driven by the expansion of global markets, and as merely dominated by the extension of corporate power across the world. Of course, these are part and parcel of globalizing influences in our lives, but simply to equate globalization with these phenomena, I think, is fundamentally wrong. Globalization is much more profound than this. The best way to represent what's going on is that there is a sort of shift in the basic institutions of our lives, which is happening from, as I mentioned a minute, going all the way through from many aspects of our personal lives to the largest forms of transnational institutions. Globalization, I think, is plainly social, political, cultural, as well as economic, and these aspects of globalization intersect uneasily and in a diverse ways with the economic influences. Second, globalization is absolutely not just a single thing. Some people have suggested that since the term globalization is now everywhere, you know, you can't escape it, that we should actually drop it. And I must say I do have some sympathy with that point of view, because the term is at best a kind of portmanteau term referring to a number of overlapping changes transforming the world. There is not a single change which you can label globalization. You must not reify the notion of globalization. Globalization, if you like, means living in the global age, as the title of this lecture is taken to indicate, but the forces driving this are complicated, they're often contradictory, they often act in opposite ways to one another. Besides the impact of markets, you have the impact of the core of this course, media and communications. Communications revolution is, to my mind, quite fundamental, really, to the intensifying of globalization over the past 20 or 30 years. Many of the big events of our time, including the transformation of Soviet communism post-1989, that these electronic communication systems deeply involved in those changes. Everyone who studied the 1989 revolutions, for instance, comes away convinced that television was a major influence on them, and that television, as it influenced those changes, also influenced other transformations which happened in the world. No one thought that Eastern Europe could be transformed without violence, but no one thought that apartheid, or not many people thought that apartheid in South Africa would disappear largely without violence. These things happened in a sort of sequence, and I believe they're part of a kind of global dialogue, really, about democracy, something which, again, I'll come back to a bit later. The causes of globalization, however, include the ending of the Cold War. Ending of the Cold War has to be seen as a major, partly independent, but partly linked set of changes, creating essentially a new kind of world in which we now live. I take it it's pretty obvious that these forces are often contradictory, so that if you ask why there is now so much emphasis in many parts of the world on local nationalisms, local cultural identity, the reasons for this are deeply bound up with globalization. Globalizing forces tend to produce a kind of accentuation of local identity. This accentuation of local identity is in some part a resistance to globalizing influences, but is also causally bound up with them. So living in the global age means living in a kind of contradictory, fragmentary, conflictful world, not one which is driven by a single set of changes, and certainly not one which is producing an easy kind of unity for our lives. Thirdly, I also think it's a really basic mistake to suppose that globalization simply concerns the big systems, that globalization is only about large-scale institutions or large-scale changes. I think Manuel Castells, in his famous book on the Network Society, his famous three-volume study, is quite right to say that globalization operates around two poles or two extremes. One is the transformation of global institutions, certainly. Absolutely true. You have a global knowledge-based economy emerging. You have transformations of nations, transformations of sovereignty, and so forth. But at the other pole, you have transformations of personal identity, of the basic characteristics of our personal lives. Living in the global age is something very different psychologically, experientially, from living in previous ages, or so I believe. So for me, globalization is not just an out there phenomenon, not just the big institution type phenomenon, it's also an in here phenomenon. You don't really understand what's going on in these changes if you're not able to relate these two extremes or these two poles around which globalization is transforming our lives. Living in the global age is not just living in a world dominated by new transnational institutions. It forces on us, as I say in a minute, a kind of personal examination, a kind of personal interrogation of self, a transformation of many of the lineages of our emotional lives, which is the source of many of our difficulties, but also has strong emancipatory components for us, or again, so I think. Finally, in this litany of qualifications, one also has to say that it's a basic mistake to treat globalization as simply something coming as an external force working on us. So many people think of globalization in this way. They think that here we are as a society, the little old UK, or here we are as one bit of the little old UK or Europe, and we've got these big global forces which are acting on us. But this is at best a very partial picture, because we are the driving forces of many of these transformations. Every time you make a phone call, every time you put any money in the bank, every time you switch on your computer, you are driving forward. And indeed, every time women make changes in their personal lives and demand more out of their lives, these are driving forces of globalization. Globalization is not something which simply happens to us. It is something we are making happening. We are making happen in our day-to-day lives. And you have to grasp this kind of dialectic, really, between action and reaction, between, as we might have put it in the old days of sociology, action and structure, as sort of, again, deeply involved in all of this. You get much too passive a notion of globalization if you fail to realize this. This is not a point limited to the rich countries. It is not a point limited to the rich or the middle class within those countries. More or less everywhere, globalization is driven along by the active responses of people to the changes around them. And if you don't understand that, again, you can't really, I think, expect, you can hope to deal with the problems and the opportunities which globalization faces us with. Now, there are many problems that you could discuss of the edges, the mixture of opportunity and damage which living in the global age presents for us. I shan't pretend to cover all of these problems, and I shan't pretend to discuss even the ones I do cover in a completely effective or exhaustive way. But there are four basic problems of living in the global age which I want to concentrate on and say something about. I'll present them as problems, but I do want to stress each of these areas is not just an area of problems. It's also an area of opportunities, and it's somehow grasping this mixture of opportunity and potential harm which must be involved in somehow coping with all these changes which are comprised under this rudimentary label of globalization. And these are the four questions that I'd like to discuss. First, how do we cope with the new risks which globalization produces for our lives? Because as I'll be saying in a second or two, there is no doubt that the risk situations we face today are in some respects as different from those of the past as the current period of globalization is different from the past. Second, what do we do about the new inequalities that seem to be emerging, not just within the developed countries, but also on a more global level between the poorer countries of the world and the richer countries of the world? Third, how do we cope with the problems which globalization seems to produce for democracy and for democratizing processes. Again, both in developed parts of the world and less developing countries of the world. Fourth, can our personal lives take the strain? Can we as individuals, can we living in families, can we in our emotional lives take the strain of living in a world of pretty rapid change, a world where if we are at a new frontier, you know, you therefore can't depend upon past habits and past customs to cope with the things we face in our lives? Is the pressure going to be too great for us to reconstruct our personal lives in an effective fashion? Obviously, these are all big questions, so please don't expect conclusive answers, but I hope they'll at least stimulate some debate in the discussion we'll have afterwards. First, the risks that we face. I think it is easy to see that living in an increasingly globalized world produces new risk situations which are different from those of the past, not only in their scope, because some of them are very large, some of them affect most or everybody living in the world, but also because there is a different tissue, there is a different structure to the risk situations we face today from those of the past. The reasons for this are not just to be traced to globalization. It's very easy when you're using this portmanteau concept globalization to suppose you can explain everything through it, and then you get this absurd contest that I mentioned earlier of those who for or against globalization. When you talk about new risks, you are talking to some extent about global influences, but you're also talking about the advance of technology, the increasing role that science plays in our lives, to some extent driven by global forces, of course, and other changes which are affecting us. Where globalization produces new risks is especially around the areas of increasing interdependence. If you want a shorthand definition of globalization, it could of course be increasing interdependence. And interdependence has many virtues. It can help us create a more integrated global society. I believe it can, actually. But of course it has this shadow or dark side, because the more independent we are, the more vulnerable we are to the dangers which we have to face. Now, how should one analyze out the risk situations which we face? Because it's clear there are plenty. They involve ecological risks, for example. Many of those are global. They involve economic risks, because when you have a global economy, what happens in one part of the world instantaneously can affect what happens in other parts of the world. We don't really know how stable the global economy is, because there's never been a global information economy before. No one knows how stable or enduring that will be. So in many respects, I think you can see we are in a different sort of framework for assessing risk. Now, nature of this framework, I think, is very interesting, and there's been a lot of very informative work on it in recent years, to which the LSE has contributed, because alongside the mighty media and communications program, there is an equally mighty risk program in the LSE, which we raised a lot of money for, and I hope the two will intersect a bit, because there are relations between them. And risk has emerged, I think, in the early part of the 21st century as a kind of unifying notion, a kind of unifying concept, a bit like globalization itself. And I think the risk program in the LSE will make big contributions to it. What do we know? Well, we know that the new risk situations don't obey the logic of old risk situations. The easiest way to show this is to show that the usual way of calculating risk by insurance companies or by others who cover risks, like the welfare state, because obviously the welfare state is essentially a risk management system. It's a kind of collective insurance system. It's the main thing that it is, really. The kinds of risks which those traditional systems cover can be measured in terms of looking at an historical series. So that if you want to calculate health risk, for example, or you want to calculate risk of traffic accidents, or you want to calculate, as insurance companies do, or did until recently, the effects of climate on the risks which the insurance companies cover. In the past, you always use actuaries to do this, and to some extent it's true of the present too. So every time you step into a car, an actuary can tell you what your chances of being involved in a fatal accident or a less damaging accident might be, because you have a long historical series to go on. The new risk situations are not like this. In the new risk situations, which tend to be much more enveloping because of their connection with globalization, you often don't know what the level of risk is at all, and you can't use actuarial methods to analyze the level of risk. Very, very important, because governments, insurance companies always get used to having experts who can tell you what the risk is of a given happening. But in the case of global warming, in the case of most ecological risks, in the case of the increasing variety of health risks which are involved with the invasion of science into diet, into the body, into so many aspects of our personal lives, you can't use these techniques of risk assessment. Moreover, you can't turn to experts to give you conclusive information on the basis of which you can determine how to react. The best way of seeing this is to study the BSE debacle, which is now, as everyone will know, a European-wide phenomenon. It was a great mistake to treat BSE as though it was simply the result of commercial shady dealing and somehow to be traced to Mrs. Thatcher's malign influence on British society. There was an element of that in it, but it is. Say no more, because I'm going out on video. That's what these bright lights are all about. It limits what you can say, I tell you, in these lectures. But you should see BSE and the continuing debate over BSE as actually a prototypical new risk situation brought about by our attempts to grapple with the impact of science and technology, particularly as science and technology become globalized. What you find in new risk situations is the experts will disagree with one another, so that you cannot turn to them to get conclusive evidence of how to react. This is even still true of global warming, where although there is a pretty strong consensus among scientists that global warming is a reality, that it is already happening, that it does come from pollution produced by human beings, there are still plenty of people who doubt, reputable scientists who doubt most of these things. We won't know until it's too late, of course. Therefore, we have to act as though there is a risk without knowing completely what it is or what its consequences will be. In the case of BSE, no one knows at the moment whether BSE has stored up some kind of pandemic for this country and for the other countries of Europe. At the moment, it looks as though the risk might be relatively small and might affect only a few people. But absolutely nobody knows, because not even the mechanism of transmission is known, because this is not a disease which is like other diseases. It's linked in some way to human intervention in nature. And many of the new risks are bound up with such intervention into what used to be natural relationships, now are partly mediated by human technology. It could be the case that many thousands of people will die from BSE in this society as much as 10 to 15 years from now. Some illnesses can have a 25-year incubation period. You only have to sort of look back at the history of smoking to see, you know, how these things can change, because only about 40 years ago, smoking was actively recommended by doctors as a calmant, as a relaxant. No one knew that smoking would store up 25 years later massive problems for the health of the populations where smoking is widespread. Can we deal with these new situations? I believe on the whole, yes. Most of them we probably can do, but we have to recognize that we need a new political framework and new mechanisms from dealing with the old risk situations. This has to involve, surely, public dialogue between scientists, politicians, and lay people, because scientists, you can't leave the new risk situation simply to technical interventions of scientists. It took the British government a long while to learn this. Maybe it still, even now, hasn't learnt it, but this you cannot do. You must therefore try to bring the management of these risks within a wider dialogical framework. You can't apply the precautionary principle to them, I don't think. You can't simply say, let's limit scientific change. In the case of genetically modified foods, let's just get out there and trample all over them. What you must do in all new risk situations is make a decision between, like in globalization itself, between the balance between benefit and danger. Danger exists, risk exists if you don't introduce new technologies as well as if you do. You're talking about, therefore, essentially about the management of especially science and technology. And a good deal of the ecological debate is really about how we should manage these when they both have become globalized, when the speed of scientific advances has become much faster than the past, and our lives have been much more invaded by science and technology than was ever true of any generation in the past. But as with all of these situations, I would say no reason to be wholly pessimistic. In each of these problem areas, there are good reasons to be optimistic too. Again, we can explore that in discussion. Second, the new inequalities. One of the major things, not the only thing, that people in the streets complaining about globalization is that globalization produces a yawning gap between the richer countries of the world and the poorer countries, and produces increasing gaps between rich and poor in the developed countries too. Now, in tackling this problem area of globalization, you have to start again by rescuing the notion of globalization itself. The people in the streets protesting in Seattle say globalization is causing increasing inequalities in the world. This, by and large, I think anyway, is simply false. You cannot attribute increasing inequality directly to globalization. No matter what, whether you use a thin notion of globalization, free markets, or a thick notion of globalization, as I'm suggesting one should use. It's pretty easy to show this empirically. If you look at the best studies we have, for example, some of them carried out in the US, of the reasons why inequality increased over a period of some 25 years from the late 1970s, from the early 1970s onwards. The best studies we have show that if you have a thin notion of globalization as open markets, competitive markets, this at most accounts for about 5% of the variance in the US economy over that period. Much more important is technological change. Technological change accounts for something like 20%. Of the increased economic inequalities over that period. But the biggest factor, actually, is the last element of I was talking about, change in personal life, change in marriage and the family. About 50% of changes producing increased inequality in the US are the result of changes affecting the nature of the family, increasing proportion of single-parent families, in a society which only has, in spite of its wealth, a relatively rudimentary welfare state to cope with and respond to these changes. If you look more broadly at the relationship between the developed and less developed countries, and again we have a lot of empirical evidence on this, a lot of evidence now, as a result of recent studies, it is simply not the case that expanding globalization correlates with increasing inequality. Even if, again, you take a very narrow notion of globalization, as most of the proponents and protesters do, as the expansion of free trade, let's say, and you look at the relationship between free trade and inequality, you don't actually discover any systematic relationship, or if there is one, it is a positive one rather than a negative one. If you look at poorer countries which have had open economies, over the past 15 or so years, we've got some very good studies of this recently, and you compare them with poorer closed economies, the poorer open economies have growth rates of about 5% on average, whereas the poorer closed economies have growth rates of 0%. The problem with inequality, therefore, put very crudely, in the less developed parts of the world, is not that globalization is creating the inequalities we see. It is lack of involvement with globalizing processes. You have a whole continent, Africa, which stands largely outside these processes and is suffering as a result. No one could claim there is a simple set of relationships here, and again, I'm sure we can discuss this afterwards. But what we can say is that we only know one way of overcoming poverty, one prime way of overcoming poverty, and that is economic growth in which the poor participate. No other means of alleviating poverty, say redistribution globally or redistribution within societies, has any hope of getting close to the impact of that equation. So we need to look at processes which allow us to harness economic development and include the poor. Generally speaking, again, very crudely speaking, I would say during the era of free market philosophy, this did not happen. Neoliberal dominance, politically and philosophically, of the global economy produced quite often substantial economic growth, but it did not produce a situation where the poor benefited from this economic growth. What we have to look for is a situation where we can produce such benefits, and I think to do so you need active political intervention. One of the lessons of studying globalization is that rather than creating less need for government, rather than creating less need for active state intervention, it creates more than was the case before, but it has to take a different form from those forms of intervention to which we became accustomed. Third, what about the impact of globalization on democracy? Here I think you've got a very interesting tale to tell and intriguing consequences which stem from it. And here I think the aspect of, again, this inclusive notion of globalization which you're talking about is especially, again, the impact of media and communications. It seems to me that the globalization of media, the emergence of something like a global information society, is deeply bound up with the spread of democratic institutions across the world. I already mentioned the impact of media and communications on the transformation of communism. Communism as an authoritarian system, political power, became functionally incompatible with the need of living in a diverse world where citizenry become increasingly empowered by their access to information. And I think, therefore, it's not surprising that if you look at the history of liberal democracy over the past 30 or so years, there are far more, even by a strict and narrow definition of democracy, there are far more democratic countries in the world now than there were 30 years ago. Even allowing for the fact there are far more countries in the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union than there were 30 years ago, some people say as many as three times as many democratic countries in the world, using a pretty strict definition of democracy. Don't know how stable these democratic transitions, of course, will turn out to be. I think the globalization, when you mean by this, the spread of a global information order, is deeply bound up with these changes. There is a kind of structural compatibility between the new kind of society which is emerging, especially the role of media communications in it, and structural transformations towards democracy. Yet, what the media giveth, the media taketh away. In all the developed countries, and less developed countries, which have become democracies, one can see that democracy is under strain, that democratic institutions are becoming, to some extent, delegitimized, that you have lower levels of voting, lower levels of involvement in the political system in nearly all industrial countries over precisely this period, some 30 years or so. You find the proportion of people, for example, who say they trust politicians now is minuscule compared to what it was 30 years ago. And the younger generation, people under 25 or so, are those who are most disinclined to vote in democratic societies. What's happening here? Well, what's happening here, I would submit to you, is the other side of the same process. Media and communications, at the same time as they are producing the expansion of democratic institutions across the world, are altering the structures of democracy and are creating significant problems for us along the way as they do so. And there are just a couple of aspects of this which I'd like to mention. First of all, the media, in principle, open up space for democratic dialogue. That's the positive side of these changes. But at the same time, they immediately invade the very space they open up by a relentless commercialization, by a relentless trivialization of significant questions, by an emphasis on the short term rather than the long term. They deconstruct the very public space for dialogue which they help open up. Second, increasingly, the media constitute the political sphere, not just describe the political sphere, and as they do so, they at best alter the structures of democracy. The media pretend to report upon political events, but actually they become constitutive of a good deal of what the political field is. You only have to look at the activities of politicians in all countries, really, again, developed and less developed, to see that what politicians must do first and foremost is respond to the media, and they have to respond to the media on a daily basis. No more the idea that you let people for 4 years or 5 years, they go away and govern you, you decide at the end of that process whether to put them back in power or not. Still exists, of course, but now democracy is a daily confrontation with the media. And this daily confrontation, so far as I can see, almost automatically bypasses Parliament, because if politicians have to respond immediately to media interventions and do so as they do on a daily basis, I mean, if you think of the power of the media, think of John Humphreys on the Today programme. The Today programme seems to report upon the news, but it's pretty obvious that it constitutes the news, because John Humphreys will say, as Mr. Portillo said 10 minutes ago on this programme, what was supposed to be reporting becomes immediately a news item. Moreover, John Humphreys sounds positively aggrieved if a politician doesn't accept an invitation to go on the Today programme, as though it is an automatic right of the programme to expect that the politicians will appear there. And you can see why, because it is a very significant formative influence over British public opinion. These changes, whatever they mean, are clearly significant changes affecting the structure of democratic institutions in nearly all societies. Do they subvert democracy? Well, maybe they do and maybe they don't. There is a very interesting discussion of this. Those of you who've read recent stuff by Dick Morris, who used to be Mr. Clinton's political advisor, he's written two interesting books on these issues, The New Prince and Democracy.com, about the influence of the internet, where he argues that what is emerging is actually a kind of direct democracy in which the media are playing a new role. In other words, politicians are on trial all the time. They're on trial by the media, but responding to media stories and so on can generate democratic legitimacy, or so he says. Anyway, there are big problems as well as interesting possibilities in all of that, which again we could discuss after I finish in 5 minutes' time, you will be pleased to know. Fourthly and finally, can our personal lives take the strain? Well, what's happening there? What's happening in our personal lives, I would say, is as follows. In our personal lives, many of the aspects of global developments are having the effect of removing the role of custom, tradition, habit even, from many of the things that we do. In the past, if you consider the institution of marriage, for example, in the past, in a country like this one, marriage was an institutionalized phenomenon. If you got married, you knew what you were doing, in some sense or another, anyway. It's an arguable point, I would say. Nevertheless, if you were a woman, you knew what marriage held out for you, tended to be a life of bringing up children, domesticity, maybe a part-time job, so forth, interrupted career. If you were a man, you knew you were supposed to be the breadwinner, go out and earn a wage to support your family. Well, that is no longer true. Marriage has become deinstitutionalized. It's become stripped of these institutional supports, as you might say, for better or for worse, in contemporary societies. All over the world, not just in the, again, the developed countries, but in more, quote, traditional, unquote, countries, the role of tradition is coming into question. We live our lives, you want to put it this way, much less as fate than previous generations do. And anyone who's a woman will know the significance of this. Women have moved away from the identification of their lives as simply given by fate, as forced into a certain role which they have to follow. And therefore, men's lives, of course, have shifted in tandem. Part and parcel of the globalization debate is simply a debate about the future of the family. It has to be. Because the family is so deeply affected by these changes. That debate obviously polarizes people just as much as the wider globalization debate does. What kind of take should one have on it? Well, this is my take on it. I don't think there's any future for the traditional family. The traditional family, as I would understand it, was essentially an economic unit based on the dominance of men over women. That dominance usually sanctified by law. For example, in Britain, women were legally chattels of their husbands, possessions of their husbands, until the beginning of the 20th century. The impossibility of rape within marriage was the last residue of the idea that a woman is a possession of a husband within the marital state. There can't be any going back, surely, in a democratizing society to that kind of family. And that was the traditional family, not the family of the 1950s, the longer-term traditional family, based on a very different society from the kind in which we live. What should our family type be like? Well, families for us, I think, personal relationships for us, have to be based much more on active trust rather than simply passive acceptance of institutional roles. The arrival of a discourse of intimacy, of a discourse of sensitivity on the part of men, of a discourse of communication, very much bound up with these changes. Even the very idea of a relationship is only about as old as the idea of globalization, really. More important for us, in a way, than the question, are you married, is how good is your relationship? Because more important than the legal sanctification of marriage, or it could be argued, is the nature of the relationship in which you're embedded, not only with your spouse or partner, but also with your children. No going back, I would say, to borrow one of Mrs. Thatcher's phrases, only going forward. But going forward, I feel, as in all these problem situations, however, could be very positive. Because what we're talking about, I think, is the possible emergence of a much more democratic emotional life for us, based upon equality of the sexes rather than inequality, based upon emotional communication rather than power or violence, based upon openness rather than covert power of tradition or the law or sexual dominance. These things suggest a positive role for what I often called a democracy of the emotions in personal life. We're in a very much a transitional stage in the global society because most forms of religious fundamentalism are extremely hostile to the equality of the sexes and to the emergence of postmodern families, if you want to put it that way. Postmodern families perhaps can be as stable as traditional families were, but they will have to depend on different mechanisms from the past. So in all these problem areas and others that I could mention, I would want to argue, like the phenomenon of globalization itself, there is no single dominant good or bad side. In all of these problem situations, there are many opportunities for us, as well as forms of damage and harm which we have to try to control. Like globalization itself, these new problem situations are multifaceted and often contradictory. And there is a great deal of work to be done to maximize their positive side. I suppose on the whole, I'm an optimist and I believe that this work can be done. I think that we do have the chance of creating for the first time an effective global cosmopolitan order. I think we can do something about global inequality. I think we can, as it were, remaster this kind of runaway world in which we find ourselves. But to do so involves an effort of the political will, will involve government and not just business, will involve civil society and not just government. But you can see, I think, a possible shape for the 21st century, which would be doing something which the 20th century failed to do because the first age of globalization terminated in terrible failure. Terrible, terrible failure with so many people killed in war in the 20th century. Such a seamy downside to the 20th century. When you look at the rise of far-right parties in Europe today, and you see problems affecting families and so forth, you could be excused for taking a dreary or pessimistic scenario for our century. But I think at least we stand more chance than the 20th century did. I think this is a much more intense global age. I think we do have the chance of intervening in it. The forces of globalization are not like forces of nature. They can be controlled by active human intervention. And to this end, we should really be bending our will in the years to come. Thanks very much indeed. Now we've got this little question time, if anybody wants to ask a question. You always ask a question. I'd ask people to take the microphones because then everyone in the room can hear what is going on, including people upstairs where they're also on microphones.
Before the
You have to hold them close to your mouth, but not too close. Probably I was holding it too close, actually.
Before the discussion broadens out, could I request a mise au point about this new joint master's program? Each participant is part of a larger entity, namely London University and University of Southern California, respectively. Will the degree at the end of this program be a joint award by London University and the University of Southern California? But that was the preliminary. The actual question is, I wonder if you'd have
a... I mean, this is a brilliant first question because I don't have to answer it, and I'll turn over to Roger to answer it.
But your question comes also about...
Why don't you answer it first, though, Roger?
I will answer it very briefly. There are two separate degree programs. The students who are registered here and go to the Annenberg School will get a University of London degree in global media and communications. There's a parallel program that the Annenberg School is launching, registering their students who come in their second year to the LSE, and they will get a degree from the Annenberg School, University of Southern California.
Yeah. And my question for Professor Giddens.
Top student gets a ticket to Muscle Beach. especially if female, because that's all the rage these days.
Would you amplify a bit on your statement that globalization creates an increasing need for intervention by government? Because this runs counter to many of the assertions in that domain.
Indeed it does. I mean, I think we live in a world where markets are out of control and where corporate power is too strong. That's almost the obverse of the previous age where government in many parts of the world was too strong. So it's okay to say many of our problems are caused by government, because they have been, I think. You know, governments have done awful things to their populations in many parts of the world. But now we're a rather different world, which is too much the other way round. And it's a world which needs increasing political intervention, in my view. However, not just at a national level. I mean, I don't believe that globalization destroys the power of the nation state, and I think that national political power still counts for a lot, especially collaboration between nations. But we have to look for forms of governance above the level of the nation state. That's why, to me, the European Union is so important, because the European Union essentially began as a pre-globalization phenomenon. It began as a Cold War entity, essentially. But now it's essentially an experiment in responding above the level of the nation to globalizing influences, where nations have agreed to pool their sovereignty in order to achieve more than any could operating on an individual level. In other parts of the world, you have Mercosur looking at its role in Latin America. You have ASEAN in Asia. You have parallel organizations in the Middle East, even emerging, and in Africa. So these could be bridgeheads towards greater global governance, I feel. So when you're talking about increasing the role of government, you're not talking about returning to the old bureaucratic state, I think. You're not talking about returning to a society where the state simply tells you what to do. You're looking for an expansion of governance, including the nation, but also below and above the level of the nation. Decentralization of power, recovering of power by local communities is a key part of this, and as I was trying to argue, is actually you get more leverage for that with globalization, contrary to what people think, rather than less. There's real possibilities of recovering local power in the global age, which weren't so available before. Could we have one question from upstairs?
Yes, there's one just on the front corner there.
Wait, I would ask you though to wait for the old microphone.
Slowly towards
or otherwise you. Shout a lot.
Right at the beginning of your speech, you spoke about a body of
of empirical work that pretty conclusively proved that the first phase of globalization was over, and that there was no longer a question about whether globalization was really a concept to be taken seriously or not. I wonder if you could elaborate for those people who are still wondering and still perhaps a little bit skeptical about the whole notion of globalization. Elaborate a little on some of that empirical work.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a globalization skeptics tend to be on the old left by and large, because they want to say most political structures stay intact, that this is all largely hype about nothing. It's a kind of neoliberal plot to attack the welfare state, that kind of thing. And there are respectable academic texts which defend that kind of position, the most important being Hurst and Thompson's Globalization in Question, which has gone through two editions, and the new edition is a very good source for anyone who wants an entree into that debate. But I think their position has shifted significantly since they first set it out, and as I would take it, as much as you ever get any kind of agreement on these issues, the weight of opinion has shifted very much in the other direction. And I have in mind the kind of research by the individual I quoted, David Held and his colleagues, in David Held's book, Global Transformations. You have massive sources of empirical evidence on the debate. You have a long-term look at the history of prior eras of what you might call globalization or internationalization or whatever. You have all sorts of evidence amassed from particular countries and more generic forces in the world. And that's only one of quite a large number of more recent, authentic, I think, academic issues. There's a lot of hype on these issues, as you know. And so I think the evidence, in my view, the evidence is really solid, but anything can be disputed, and there is still, you know, there are still the dregs of that dispute going on. It's not, to me, I would stress that recognizing that this is a new global age in many respects does not mean accepting that nations and states can't do a great deal to pursue social democratic imperatives, because I think they can. But I do think that the old policies have often lapsed and you need new ones to do that now. Essentially, for me, that's what this, you know, much derided or celebrated third way debate is all about. It's about how you escape from the kind of straitjacket of neoliberal philosophy on the one hand and traditional state-based Keynesian bureaucratic leftism on the other. And I think quite a lot of progress is being made there as well. But of course you might disagree, and it's a very open field for discussion still. Please, could you just get the old microphone?
Thank you. I wish to turn our attention to the media, in particular the internet as a new form of medium. Now, I think this could have a very positive influence on the whole world situation and become more and more positive as time unfolds. The one caution I'd apply here is, in doing that, we need to make sure that as many people as possible have access to internet resources. But there are many signs that is in fact the case, but most people now do seem to be getting capability of widespread internet access. Now, I myself, I'm in process of setting up a positive, forward-looking, holistic website, which I hope will transform the whole impact of media situation for the better. It will inform people in outline about a very wide variety of different aspects of life, especially about new ideas that are in the air.
Yeah, I mean, you could ask, if the internet is so important, why are people bothered to turn up tonight, and why are you here asking this question in person? Because it shows you that new technologies don't destroy the need for personal presence and personal involvement, I think. But I think actually the impact of the internet is so problematic that it's just a matter of taste, whether you take your view or the alternative view, political taste really, or if you like, two forms of political imagination, because so far as one can see, you were at the beginning of internet technologies, nowhere near the end of the impact of the internet, which could indeed be tremendous. But on the one hand, you've got people who say the internet is producing new forms of democratization. Dick Morris, actually, the guy I quoted in the lecture, is one of those. If you're interested in that, you should look at this book that he just wrote, democracy.com, which is interesting, I think, because he argues in that book that in the US, where you have the highest rate of internet take-up, that the old politics of sound bites, media short messages, being on message, all that is largely over, or is coming to be over. That's the old kind of media relationship, he says, with politics. And as you get an expansion of the internet, people want more in-depth treatments of political and other issues. And he says the impact of the internet will produce a kind of renewal of direct democracy in this fashion, and that the role of media will move much more back towards issue-based, in-depth elaboration rather than soundbite truncation. I mean, I have strong doubts about that, but that's what he argues, and it is quite interesting. So there is a point of view. I think what, to my mind, is definitively wrong is the sort of libertarian idea that the advent of the internet will simply return power to everybody. I think the internet is much more likely, in my view, to reflect wider systems of inequality and power, because it is only a technology in the end. No technology is going to save the world, so it's probably going to reflect the very kinds of inequalities and lapses in democracy which its advocates suppose that it will correct. So I suppose I don't really think myself that the internet is probably going to have the profound role which some people do in respect of democracy and so forth. Much more likely it's going to reflect and elaborate upon inequalities and problems that have to be tackled by other means. It may be a partial solution. As you'll know, recent research seems to show that the use of the internet for early education for children, contrary to the hype of politicians, is problematic. That screen-based, problem-based learning, in which computers play a big role, is perhaps a not particularly effective way of helping the early education of children, not as effective as many advocates and enthusiasts would like us to believe. But the evidence is still, going back to evidence, a bit thin on that area too. Someone over here with a very insistent hand, so we're going to... Well, I was going to... Here's the mic. Mr. Two Mics.
Hi, Mike. You've sort of... It's on.
Yeah. I think it's on. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
You've sort of hinted that the harshest days of neoliberalism have somehow passed, but I don't see the evidence for that, that things have moved on, or, I mean, all the evidence is that the consolidation of transnational power is intensifying, and most particularly with the General Agreement on Trade and Services being formulated over the next 2 years, which could see the opening up of public spending to liberalisation and to transnational companies. Where's the evidence that you've sort of suggested that we've sort of passed this hump, that we're getting into something different, something more humane, but I don't see that. Where is it?
Yeah. Well, that's my view for two reasons, really. I mean, neoliberalism is political philosophy essentially linked to an economic philosophy. And first of all, politically, I think all across the world people have voted down neoliberalism. Neoliberalism in politics means Thatcherism or Reaganism. It means the idea that you simply leave people exposed in the face of global market forces. Well, electorates, I think, have shown pretty clearly they don't want that, because global market forces produce too many insecurities and too many inequalities to have a decent life, and therefore the resurgence of the left in many countries across the world, I would say, is at least to some degree an indication of that. That is, for example, you have 12 out of 15 EU countries now led by left of centre governments, whatever you make of that. Second, I think the era of the Washington Consensus has largely passed. I mean, it is a consensus no more. You could say that inside the IMF you still have the last high priests, really, of a sort of fairly straight down the line neoliberal political philosophy. But in the World Bank, I think, especially since the advent of Wolfensohn, the general outlook of the World Bank shifted very substantially, because they now emphasize much more social approach to poverty. They emphasize much more institutional framework for development. And I'm very much in favor of the kind of views that Joe Stiglitz has expressed in some very interesting papers he wrote when he left the World Bank, where he's essentially arguing for a sort of third way of global development, because he says in the first 30 or so years after the war, people thought the state could do the business for development, and that proved to be false. Then they thought markets could do the business for development, and that proved to be at best partial. Now he says, and I agree with him, we need to look for a different relationship between government, market forces, and civil society, and we need to do so on a local, national, and transnational level too. So, well, I think, to my mind, it's sort of all around us, because the nature of the debates have changed a lot. Not many people any longer, if you look at the debates, what used to be called the Washington Consensus, and the shift of political attitudes that I mentioned earlier.
I think we might.
Well, it seems to me it's big change, so I just disagree with you on that.
Can we move on to another question? And perhaps it will probably have to be the last. There's a lady with the in red who's been very persistent too.
First, I wanted to say, actually, unfortunately, not in all countries, neoliberalism is not anymore in government. For example, in my country, Austria, unfortunately, we have this kind of new government. But my question was, especially in ecological way, I can't really see, I'm not optimistic anyway, because last week the conference in The Hague, it failed. So how can you be optimistic in this way? I mean, when you see an ecological issues, nothing happens.
Yeah, well, as I said, there are plenty of good reasons for pessimism if you're temperamentally inclined that way, or if that's your take on the evidence. Well, I mean, in Russia, you do have fundamental problems of transition. You have real difficulties in East European countries. You have many countries across the world where democracy is at best fragile. You have various kinds of retreats from the advances that have been made. You have all the problems I mentioned, plus others. So grounds for pessimism are not too hard to find. On the other hand, I think there's a pretty fair balance in that, because I think there are lots of emancipatory forces which are alive in the world and which can be harnessed, not just by government alone, but by other agencies too. For example, if you consider the role of warfare and violence, you can make a reasonable case to say that out of touch from the people upstairs are making growling noises or something. Someone up is there. You can make a reasonable, I think, case to say that what Mary Caldor calls old wars, wars between nations, the kind of vastly destructive wars which have happened in the 20th century, might become less and less common. And I think there's good reason to suppose that is a real possibility. That would be fantastic advance for the world. In their place, you get these horrific local conflicts. Horrific they are, you know, barbaric they are, but they're not of the same order as the world wars or the wars between nations, which have proved so destructive. 200 million people have been killed in war during the course of the 20th century. So you can find plenty of grounds for optimism too, and if you're temperamentally inclined that way, if you believe that the world is there to be saved, why not go out and try and save it? I think, you know, that kind of mission can be reactivated. I don't see grounds for simply passivity in the face of the forces around us. Well, can I say again, I truly support this program. This is a good day in the LSE, and thanks to Roger for organizing it.
Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you very much indeed, Tony Giddens, for a very stimulating hour. There is a reception to which you are, and I mean it, all invited, on the third floor of this building in the Robinson Room, wine and bits, and somebody's got to drink and somebody's got to eat, so please join us for an hour or so upstairs. Thank you very much indeed.